gentleman by the name of Kerry Reich, who spent many years of his own working on what he intended to be a multi-volume biography of Rockefeller, published the first volume in 1996, which took the story up to Nelson's election as governor. So it's a wonderful book and a great continuing resource for Rockefeller students. And then suddenly, tragically, at the age of, I think, 48, 49, he was diagnosed 2 years later with pancreatic cancer and died a couple weeks later. So I can be forgiven, I think, for wondering if there was a curse on this project.
You know, we're about 30 minutes into a 90-minute conversation. I still haven't asked you about the last chapter, which, as you fully expect.
I appreciate your restraint.
Yes. Well, we're going to do that in a moment. Yeah. But let's jump into politics. We'll go to 1960, and here is video from the GOP convention with Nelson Rockefeller in 1960.
As the GOP convenes in Chicago, Governor Nelson Rockefeller of New York dominates the scene in the early hours, although declaredly not a candidate for either the presidential or vice presidential nominations. His proposals for the Republican platform, agreed to by Vice President Nixon, touched off a storm of controversy. Mr. Nixon's overwhelming position as the GOP favorite was unshaken, but interest in the convention was roused beyond early expectations.
So you see that and think what?
Well, first of all, it's a remarkable fact that as late as 1960, Richard Nixon, the overwhelming favorite, really unchallenged for the nomination, nevertheless felt it was in his political interest in the middle of the night, without telling anyone on his staff, to fly to New York for a secret, turned out to be 6 or 8 hour meeting at Nelson Rockefeller's apartment. First of all, to try to persuade Rockefeller to go on the ticket as vice president. And when that failed, to meet Rockefeller's objections on the platform, which revolved overwhelmingly around two issues. Seemingly opposing, one, he wanted a stronger civil rights blank. That was an issue that always mattered to his family and to Nelson. We can hopefully talk about that later. and secondly, he wanted a stronger military defense plank. He wanted the party, in effect, to repudiate Dwight Eisenhower's policy of fiscal restraint on the budget, including the military budget. So it put Nixon in a terribly awkward position. And yet it was believed that Nelson Rockefeller and the wing of the party that he represented, the old Eastern establishment, had the clout to require this, or at least to be taken seriously. We now know that by 1960 that was probably not the case. It was a matter of perception. It was fed by what today we would call the mainstream media.
And what did Richard Nixon and Rockefeller think of each other?
It's a complex. They respected each other as rivals. There certainly were any number of occasions when I think each man tried the patience of the other. Oddly enough, during the Eisenhower administration, they'd been allies. They were both, in some ways, well, there's a wonderful letter Rockefeller writes the day after the 56 election, when Eisenhower was overwhelmingly reelected over Adlai Stevenson. Nelson writes, oddly enough, to Richard Nixon, and he says, "Thanks to you and the president, the Republican Party is emerging as the great liberal party of the future." And in light of everything we know since then, that seems an odd thing to say. Except in 1956, you know, people forget it wasn't Barry Goldwater that broke the solid South. It was Dwight Eisenhower. In 1956, Dwight Eisenhower carried almost 40% of the African-American vote and a majority of Southern electors. So because the party turned to Goldwater and then, in effect, on to Nixon and Reagan and Gingrich, I mean, because the party took that turn in 1964 doesn't mean that that had to be the history. It could have been a very different history.
On His Own Terms is the title of the book. Where'd you get that?
You know, in 35 years of writing books, this is the first time I've got a title that I wanted from the very beginning. That's one thing that never changed.
How old is he in that picture on the cover?
He would be, that would be early 60s. So he would be in his mid-50s. On His Own Terms seemed to me to sum up, better than any other phrase, Nelson's approach to life, to politics, to women, to art, and even arguably to death. Quick story that behind that, that goes to the heart of who he was, because it took me much of those 14 years to reach what I thought was an adequate understanding of this very elusive figure. He was incredibly close to his mother, Abby Aldrich Rockefeller, and as I say, she died in 1948. And I'd been told by someone close to him that he kept her ashes in the house at Pocantico. And Happy Rockefeller was kind enough to spend half a day with me and give me a tour, both of the house, the big house at Kikut, and the house that he built for their retirement nearby. And every Rockefeller house is built on the same floor plan. When you walk in, on the right is mother's room, and on the left is father's room. And sure enough, in mother's room, there's a 15th century funerary urn. So we were coming to the end of the tour, and I thought, what have I got to lose? So I related this story to Mrs. Rockefeller, and she said, oh, that's true. I said, really? How could that be? Because there was a funeral, and Abby's ashes were interred at the family cemetery elsewhere on the estate. And she said, oh, Nelson just reached in and grabbed a handful. Now, I don't know many people who would do that. And it tells me two things, two sides of his character. One, there's an almost childlike impulsiveness. He was utterly unselfconscious, which is, I think, makes him unique among Rockefellers and probably unusual among most of us. But it also made him an incredible campaigner, street-level campaigner. But the other thing that it also suggests is a sense of entitlement that goes beyond the norm. How many of us would entertain for a moment the notion at such a time and place of possessing one's parent in that way? That's On His Own Terms. He believed he could have life, and I believe death on his own terms.
Who picked out all of the quotes at the head of each chapter?
I did.
Why did you start with the, and I'll read it, in the prologue with the chapter from Murray Kempton, and who is he?
Murray Kempton was a great, highly respected journalist in New York. I guess you could say maybe a little left of center, but of that generation, I mean, Jimmy Breslin, first of all, New York was a newspaper town when Nelson Rockefeller went into politics in the 1950s. I don't know how many papers there were, but of course most of them are gone. But I mean, it was a newspaper town, and it generated great journalists who were, first of all, great reporters, but secondly also, as in Kempton's case, political analysts.
He's long gone, though.
He is gone, yeah.
All right, I'll read it. There came down upon Rockefeller from those galleries a howl of hatred, which was not of an opinion, but of a human being who embodied everything these people had hated for 20 years. He just stood there and began his prose in the armor of a magnificent contempt. Who cares what he said? Semicolon. It was what he was that night.
Yeah.
What night?
July 14th, 1964. The New York Times referred to it as Bastille Day in reverse. It was New York versus the rest of America. Not exactly a dispute that's gone away, I suppose. One that perhaps has been at least temporarily healed in the wake of 9/11. The fact of the matter is, the Republican Party, going back to 1912, when Theodore Roosevelt and William Howard Taft split it asunder. And TR ran a third party, progressive, liberal, we would call it, Republican campaign. For throughout the 20th century, there had been a divide. It was partly geographical. It was more ideological. It was substantive. The conservatives in the Midwest, for example, tended to be isolationists in terms of foreign policy. The Eastern liberals, the Eastern establishment, tended to be internationalists, much more, for example, much more willing to get into World War II before Pearl Harbor. They also, however, were divided about their reaction to the New Deal. The Eastern liberals were prepared to accommodate the changes, a much more active role for government. The conservatives, west of the Appalachians for the most part, held out for a more hard shell view, if you will. The liberals believed, and this is critical, Nelson Rockefeller, again, as I say, had no ideology. He believed first and foremost the problem should be taken care of through the private sector. If the private sector couldn't or wouldn't, then let's look for a partnership with government. The idea being the Eastern establishment believed, first of all, you needed a strong, robust, growing private economy, whatever it took. And government could be an agent of that. That's an idea as old as Alexander Hamilton. But if you didn't have that strong, robust private economy, you couldn't pay for the compassionate. You couldn't afford to do all of these social programs. So they thought, the horse before the cart, and they felt the New Deal was acting in reverse.
Let's go to some video from that convention in 1964, the year that they nominated Barry Goldwater in the Republican convention.
These extremists feed on fear, hate, and terror. They encourage disunity.
You control the audience, and I'll make my 5 minutes.
These are people who have nothing in common with Americanism. The Republican Party must repudiate these people.
Extremism, then as now, a topic of much discussed. First of all, you have to have a little bit of context. That convention came 1 month after passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which it's important to note was passed with Republican votes in both houses, but critically in the Senate. And a bill that Nelson Rockefeller strongly supported. In fact, he wanted to go further. He wanted a Voting Rights Act at the same time, which, of course, would come about a year later. Barry Goldwater, who, it must be said, had personally been a leader in desegregating not only his family's department store in Phoenix, but the Arizona National Guard. Nevertheless, Goldwater was of that rugged individualist school who feared federal coercion more than, quite frankly, he championed the civil rights of African Americans.
Did we see hate right there? Is that what you were saying?
Yeah, we saw a generation. It was like a volcano that had built up. Everything about New York that you hated, everything about the Eastern establishment media, which exercised a much greater centralized dominant position. There was at one point earlier in the evening, Dwight Eisenhower, by accident, he had no idea. This is 30 years before Pat Buchanan declares culture wars. Ike gets up and in an attempt to foster unity, mentions in a throwaway line, sensation-seeking columnists who couldn't care less about the good of our party. And the place explodes. And there was a famously delegate down, I think, in North Dakota, who stood up on a chair and yelled, "Down with Walter Lippmann, down with Walter Lippmann." A few hours later, there are Republican delegates on the floor with shouting at Rockefeller, "You lousy lover." I mean, it was that intense. It was a culture war.
What did that mean, by the way, you lousy lover?
It was a reference to the fact that Nelson Rockefeller had divorced his first wife and married a woman who, in the popular press, was portrayed as having, quote, abandoned her children in order to marry him.
What were the circumstances about the divorce and the remarriage to Happy Rockefeller? And what's her full name?
Margaretta Fittler, married to James Murphy. Exactly when the relationship began is murky. I believe it began earlier than has been suggested until now.
And that, what does that mean?
I would say the mid-1950s. Most accounts suggested the 1958 campaign when she worked in Rockefeller's gubernatorial campaign. But in any event, the marriage to Todd, one of the things that I discovered in the course of researching this book was that a year went by, I mean, between when Nelson wanted to announce a divorce and the actual announcement. There were people around him who even then, there were people in 1958 who had talked him out of getting a divorce before he ran for governor. They argued that this would kill your political career before it gets off the ground. He reluctantly went along. But it's very clear, certainly from then on, that left to his own devices, he intended to end his marriage to Todd, and if at all possible, marry Happy Murphy. And the circumstances were treated. Remember, this is Taylor and Burton. I mean, it's a different culture, and you know, and Hollywood adulterers. You know, 10,000 people turned out for the world premiere of Cleopatra a month after the Rockefeller Murphy marriage. You know, they were celebrated, but for a politician, and that's actually an important part of Nelson's unwitting legacy, because the fact of the matter is, really beginning with his divorce and remarriage, and sort of spectacularly advancing with the circumstances surrounding his death, the media took a whole different approach to distinguishing what was public and what was private. And we could argue over whether that has been good for democracy, but there's little doubt that he played a very significant role. Today, I don't think the circumstances surrounding his divorce and remarriage would have nearly as great an impact. But you have to remember, the Republican Party, you know, in 1962, 63, 64, was also a culturally probably more conservative than the rest of the country. Jack Kennedy, great, best line in the book, I found in Drew Pearson's unpublished diary. He couldn't believe that Rockefeller would risk everything by getting a divorce. He told Kay Graham, no man would ever love more than politics, which probably tells you more about him than anything else. But it does sum up the prevailing view.
Did you happen to ask Happy Rockefeller when you were with her for that half a day anything about the personal relationship?
Yeah, she talked very candidly about it. I remember telling her something that Bill Scranton had said to me.
Who was Bill Scranton?
Bill Scranton is former governor of Pennsylvania, recently deceased, close to Rockefeller politically, personally, and certainly because of his own mainline connections, he knew both Mrs. Rockefellers.
And ran for president.
And ran for president in 64. He knew both Todd and Happy, and he said he'd known them both, liked them both. He thought Todd was very intelligent. He liked her, but he always thought that she and Nelson were mismatched. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, you have to understand, Nelson was a man more than most who needed warmth. He said, don't make the mistake of automatically equating that with sex. Nelson needed warmth. And I understand exactly what he meant. And Happy is a very warm woman. Happy could give him really what Todd couldn't. That's a factor. The thing about that whole relationship that I think this book really breaks ground, and it's only possible because of the passage of time, if you go back and you read coverage at the time and read coverage since, every single account of the Rockefeller divorce and remarriage is couched in political terms. It's seen through the lens of what did this cost him and why on earth, you know, did he take that risk? What no one has ever asked until now, and obviously what I was interested in getting from Happy Rockefeller, was forget politics for just a moment. What were the emotional compensations that Nelson got that made him overlook whatever risks? She told me point blank they never discussed the political consequences. I believe her. She also told me something very, very poignant and shrewd at the same time. She went to New Hampshire and campaigned in 64. She was in the early stage, well, no, in the not so early stages of a pregnancy. But she went to New Hampshire. And for the most part, people were very friendly. She said you had no idea how many people wanted to feel the baby. But there were people who were anything but friendly. And she was standing on a church, the steps of a church. And these women come up and say, oh, Mrs. Murphy, you haven't brought your children with you today, which is about as nasty as you can get. And she said she learned something at that moment. She said, whenever someone says something horrible to you, you counter with a compliment. And she said, she said, my, that's a lovely dress you have on. And it disarms. It maybe even shames, and that may be too much to hope for. But it's an interesting observation, and it runs against the sort of popular notion that this was a woman who was you know, totally unversed in politics. Nelson Rockefeller had enormous faith in her judgment, in her view of the man of the street. And I still believe, although she downgrades her role in this, I think she was a pivotal part of his decision to move on the abortion issue. New York repealed its old abortion laws, and when the legislature 2 years later moved to repeal the repeal under pressure from the church, he vetoed that action. And the Supreme Court in Roe v. Wade, less than a year later, used some of Nelson's same arguments in upholding a woman's right to choose.
If I counted right, he was married to Happy Rockefeller for half the time, 16 years. That he was married to Todd was 32 years. How old would Happy Rockefeller be today?
Happy would be 88.
How many of all of his children are still alive?
He had five children by Todd and two by Happy. So of those eight, six are still living. The eldest son, Rodman, born in 1932, died several years ago. And then, of course, many years ago, there was the tragedy, almost Greek tragedy. It was like 3 days after they announced that they were separating that the word came from today's Indonesia that Michael Rockefeller, the youngest son from his first marriage, and the one everyone agrees to whom he was the closest and for whom he entertained the highest hopes, was lost.
How old was he?
Michael would have been 22, 23.
Did anybody ever find out what happened to him?
No. And I think, horrible as the experience was at the time, I think the family has been haunted, to some degree exploited, but certainly haunted ever since by continual efforts to dredge this up, to spin all sorts of horrific theories about how he may have died.
You notice I haven't asked you about the last chapter yet.
I do notice.
Let's go to 1968, where he makes an announcement in 1968 for president.
Today I announce my active candidacy for the nomination by the Republican Party for the presidency of the United States. I shall do everything I can, with all my energy, now and in the weeks before the National Convention, to bring before the people the dimensions of the problems as I see them, and how I believe as a free people we can meet them. I believe firmly that true unity is forged by full examination of the facts and the free interchange of honest convictions. And very simply, by taking this course at this time, I feel I can best serve my country.
Now, this is off the subject right there, but it, as I watched him reading, I go back to the very first thing you wrote, the very first two words in your book. Nelson Rockefeller suffered from dyslexia.
That's right. By the way, he didn't know till he was 50 years old. He hadn't heard the word till he was 50 years old. He went through his life believing he had a low IQ, that it was, in effect, an intellectual deficiency. And so he took his mother's advice from a very early age, which was always surround yourself with people who are smarter than you, which helps to explain the task forces and the experts and the panoply of gurus who surrounded Rockefeller. He couldn't spell. He was not a natural speaker from a text, but he compensated. He learned to compensate. He was extraordinary off the cuff. He was one of the great, as I say, street campaigners of all time. But put him in front of an audience with a text. The 68 is fascinating because, of course, 1 month before he got into the race, he led everyone to believe he was going to get into the race and then stunned everyone by announcing he wasn't running. Well, in between, a number of things happened. Lyndon Johnson pulled out of the race. Martin Luther King was assassinated. And by the way, one of the things I discovered, he was very close to Dr. King. He had come to the rescue of King's Birmingham crusade financially when they were running out of bail money for the kids who were demonstrating in Birmingham. And then, of course, tragically, when Dr. King was killed in April 1968, Nelson called Mrs. King, and the follow-up was he sent his advance men and organized and paid for Dr. King's funeral.
When was that first known?
He didn't want it known. He said to the advance man who I talked with that we don't want to take advantage of the family's suffering.
So when was it first published?
When he died. There was a little story to that effect. The full story only comes out now. But the other critical thing that happened during that month was on April 23rd, he was smuggled with Happy into the Johnson White House. I talked to the man who took him in and took him out.
Who was that?
Larry Temple, the head of the Johnson Foundation now, but young staffer then. And, of course, they wanted all secret. LBJ wanted Nelson to run for president. They had a very interesting relationship. Well, no, he understood he wasn't going to change parties. Now, later on, after the Republican convention, Hubert Humphrey approached Rockefeller about being his vice president. Humphrey wanted to run a national, in effect, a coalition government, a unity campaign in that year when unity was hard to come by.
By the way, in your book, you use a quote from Lyndon Johnson to head up one of the chapters. You say, Rockefeller's wife ain't going to let him get off the ground. That's from 64.
Yeah. Well, that was LBJ's considered assessment of the political realities of the time. By the way, one thing that, because it's so funny, people always look for contemporary connections. And, you know, remember the Mississippi Republican race we just went through where Senator Cochran won improbably with the support of African-American voters who had re-registered. The great climactic epic battle of the 64 campaign was Goldwater versus Rockefeller one-on-one in California, which in those days, believe it or not, there was a poll that showed 70% of California Republicans considered themselves moderates or liberals. But in any event, it was the primary campaign to end all primary campaigns. And Goldwater was way ahead. And Stu Spencer, the great political strategist from several campaigns, including Ronald Reagan's, told me what almost turned it around were African-American voters, mostly in Los Angeles, 55,000 of whom re-registered as Republicans so they could vote in the Republican primary for Nelson Rockefeller. That was indicative of the appeal that Rockefeller had to minority Americans.
Was it over for him in 68 as a candidate?
It really was.
When was it?
Oh, I'm sorry. When? Well, the fact is, when he pulled out in March, he got back in a month later. The problem was very simply, very, very quickly, twofold. One, it was a conservative party that was moving further and further to the right. They were simply uncomfortable with Nelson Rockefeller's positions. Secondly, though, was Rockefeller's own failure to understand the difference between running for the nomination and running in the fall. He always, every time he ran for president, he ran a November campaign. He ran a campaign reaching out to the general electorate. But it's not the general electorate. It's delegates who select a nominee. And the great line, he had an ironic sense of humor, which he, for the most part, managed to control, but he couldn't resist. Someone asked him at the end of the 68, after Nixon was nominated, that night he had a press conference, and there was a young reporter who citing his resume and everything else, said, you know, why haven't you been nominated for president, given all of this, your qualifications? And Rockefeller looked at him, he said, young man, have you ever been to a Republican National Convention? It was like a question that answered itself.
Did you ever meet him?
I met him three times in passing. I met him twice during the 68 campaign at campaign events. And then 7 years later, when I was an intern in the Ford White House, I met the then vice president. We had a 45-minute meeting with him. And I noticed how much older he looked. He was one of these people, if you look at pictures, certainly when he first ran for governor, he looked very youthful. He looks a lot younger than 50, which is what he was in 1958. And then about 68, age really began to catch up with him, which is one reason why I think the later years were increasingly difficult.
At the end of his life, how much money was he worth?
The estate was valued, for taxation purposes, I guess, at something over around $215, $220 million.
How much of that did he earn himself?
The bulk of it was in trusts, $116 million in trusts from his father and grandfather. The only time in his life he made money, oddly enough, was at the end of his life, in an art reproduction business, which horrified purists, but which showed real promise. He started what's called the Nelson Rockefeller Collection, had a storefront in Midtown Manhattan, and was selling reproductions of paintings and furniture and other objects d'art that he owned.
You mentioned earlier about civil rights and his interest in it, and then in 1971... we got some video and a conversation between Nelson Rockefeller and Richard Nixon. But I've heard you say in the last 14 years that your Attica chapter is maybe your best.
Well, you know, it's the one I think I'm proudest of because, excuse me, I think it's the first time, first of all, I have the benefit of perspective. 40 years have gone by. We know things we didn't know. It's a different culture. For example,
first of all, before you get there, Attica is what?
Attica is a correctional facility in upstate New York, east of Rochester and Buffalo, which, like every other place in New York and indeed throughout the country, was overcrowded, disproportionately populated by African Americans, underfunded.
And he's governor.
He's governor. Interestingly enough, he had brought in a man named Russ Oswald to run a new Department of Corrections, the idea being to begin to reform this antiquated system. But in 1971, New York State also was in a severe budget crunch, and the two priorities collided. But it's hard to make people 40 years later understand, immerse themselves in the culture of 1971. Not only the prison culture, not only the very real sense of grievance felt by prisoners and particularly African Americans about the justice system in its entirety, but also a culture in which once the takeover occurred in September 1971, part of this was just fate. Rockefeller was out of state. He was in Washington, D.C. He was not part of that unfolding process as it took place the first day of the takeover. The critical decision that was not made, the critical decision that Russ Oswald, in effect, prevented from being made, was using force at the time to immediately retake the prison. The fact is there was precedent for this in New York State. Herbert Lehman, the governor who succeeded Franklin Roosevelt, was faced with an identical situation in a prison takeover, and he took the stance that Rockefeller took, that the state would not negotiate, and eventually sent troops in and was acclaimed for it.
How many hostages were there?
Hundreds. I'm sorry. There were hundreds of prisoners involved. Over 1,000 prisoners involved. There were 43 who died in the retaking of the prison.
Who retook it?
What? And 11 of those were security guards. The rest were prisoners.
But who retook it? What kind of force?
Let me just back up a bit because. The criticism of Rockefeller is directed twofold. The takeover, which was badly botched, and the argument was always made, if Rockefeller had been there, if he had gone there, if he'd been on the scene, at the very least, he could have prevented things. He had representatives who were there, who were feeding him information and so on and so on. The negotiations involved a number of outside, quote, observers. Today, it wouldn't happen. You wouldn't invite in people like William Kunstler, who clearly had a political agenda of his own, to be a, quote, outside observer.
Very liberal activist.
Yeah, absolutely. Radical, proud of it. Radical lawyer, sort of in the Clarence Darrow tradition. You would not invite TV cameras in to observe all of this. It was just, you know, there were any number of judgmental errors that were made. Strategically, I think a strong case can be made that had there been force applied initially, because part of the prison was retaken. But Oswald was a modernizer. He was a good guy, he thought. He was a liberal, and he could negotiate. And it turned out he couldn't negotiate.
Let's listen to a little bit of this conversation between Richard Nixon, who was in the White House, 1971,
yeah,
and Governor Nelson Rockefeller.
But for the courage you showed and the judgment in not granting amnesty, it was right, and I don't care what the hell the papers or anybody else says. I don't care what they say. I think that you had to do it that way, because if you would have granted amnesty in this case, it would have meant that you would have had prisons and an uproar all over this country.
That's right.
And you did the right thing. It's a tragedy that these poor fellows are shot, but I just want you to know that's my view, and I pulled the troops around here there to back that right to the hilt.
Well, aren't you great, Mr. President? I only called you because I wanted to alert you that we were going in, and
right.
When we went in, we couldn't tell whether all 39 hostages would be killed and maybe 200 or 300 prisoners. The whole thing was led by the blacks.
Are all the prisoners that were killed blacks?
Are there any
whites?
I haven't got got that report, but I have to. I would say just offhand, yes.
Yeah.
We did it though only when they were in the process of murdering the guards, or when they were attacking our people as they came in to get the guards.
You had to do it.
And otherwise, we were captured all the cell blocks and so forth without shooting a shot. And no troopers were wounded. One of them, well, one of them was in the leg.
So what are you hearing?
In some ways, is Rockefeller at his worst? I mean, he's doing what lots of people do, which is telling the president what he thinks he wants to hear. Back up just a bit. Amnesty, they talked about. And that became, in many ways, the issue around which this revolved. The prisoners who had taken over the facility submitted a list of demands, various lists of demands. They included, among other things, the right to fly to a non-imperialist country and amnesty. The latter was pretty quickly dismissed. But many of the demands, by the way, were met, were prepared. The observers got together, they spent a day, and they went through the list. And most of the prisoner demands, which, by the way, were perfectly legitimate. I mean, one of the problems with looking at Attica is for most people then and now, it was the first time they were really exposed to just how horrible conditions were in those facilities. And then people conflated the horror of the facility with Rockefeller's refusal to go and then the botched retaking. What they overlooked was the matter to Rockefeller, the matter of principle, which was amnesty. If you granted amnesty, he believed, or for example, if he, the governor of New York, went to the prison, the first thing is they would demand that he come into the cell block, into the yard with them. And then you'd be asking for the president, and what were the long-term consequences if government gave in?
You notice we still haven't talked about the last chapter. But we are going to. But first of all, there's some video that we found that shows how the Rockefeller name lives on. And this has to do with some hip-hop artists.
My mom went to prison in 1991. My mother. 1991. Somehow, my mama ends up serving a mandatory minimum sentence of 14 years. Mom gets out in 2002. That's 11 years on a 14-year sentence, fed charges. That happened all across the hood.
The Rockefeller drug laws are unjust laws that have been on the books for over 30 years. Those laws take nonviolent first-time offenders and lock them up for a very long time. And there are many people who are innocent of any real crime, just guilty of abusing themselves. Those people sometimes go to jail for up to 20 years.
The Rockefeller drug laws.
Right. And there's no doubt that's part of the legacy. What you have to understand is, put it in context, this is the dark side, if you will, of Rockefeller's conviction that every problem had a solution, and that included drugs. He told a friend one day before these laws were introduced, you know, I wasted $1 billion. Trying to eliminate the drug scourge. There had been two separate Rockefeller programs to attack drugs, both of them failing. And so on the third try, he took this punitive approach. People gasped at the time, this sweeping, as you heard. I mean, first-time offenders typically were sent up for 15 years. Law enforcement was all but precluded from plea bargaining. So it was a drastic approach to a problem that appeared to be insoluble. The interesting thing is, I remember talking to Lawrence Rockefeller, the governor's brother, before his death, and Lawrence believed, and I think his truth to this, if Nelson had served a fifth term, realizing that the third drug program had failed, there would have been a fourth. Call it a strength, call it a weakness. He was incapable of acknowledging that there were problems that could not be solved, or that sometimes the only rational response was to do nothing. That wasn't in his vocabulary.
Looking at chapter 26.
Yes.
The head of the chapter the title of the chapter is The Day of the Dead.
Yeah,
we've talked about this a lot, but yeah. How important is this chapter to this book based on what people expect?
Well, it's important in the sense that I know there are people who will look at it first, whether out of prurient or non-prurient. There are people who will look at it to decide whether or not I'm honest, you know, whether this is a book that stands the test of historical objectivity.
Why?
Well, whether I'm part of the cover-up, in effect. I mean, I came to the conclusion that Nelson, the historically significant aspect of Nelson Rockefeller's death really is the cover-up that was improvised that night by a man named Hugh Morrow, who was Rockefeller's communications director, who thought at the time that he would protect the family from embarrassing revelations regarding the fact that Rockefeller, at the time of his death, was with a woman, not his wife. What Morrow did, of course, unintentionally, and with the best of intentions, produced the worst of results. This is a post-Watergate world, and there are first-rate reporters, people like Jimmy Breslin and Anna Quinlan and Bob McFadden, who are out there investigating the discrepancies, and cracks appear, and Morrow is forced to back off. And unfortunately, it for a generation of Americans, sadly, I think, it defined Nelson Rockefeller. I had the advantage of, again, time, 30-plus years. I had the opportunity to talk to a number of people who were more candid than they had been in the past. But I also had the opportunity, for example, I went through Joe Persico. Joe Persico wrote a memoir. He was a speechwriter for Rockefeller, recently deceased. Wonderful man and a great, great writer, great scholar of World War II, for example. Anyway, Joe Persico, in his memoir, which was published just after all of this, clearly pulled his punches, and I think appropriately so. I mean, there are questions of taste and loyalty. He'd been, part of the Rockefeller inner circle. But anyway, I had an opportunity to go through all of Joe's notes, and I wasn't interested in peeping through the keyhole either. There's one historically significant question that needs to be answered. Did Nelson Rockefeller die needlessly that night? Could he have been saved? And I came to the conclusion, first of all, what people don't know is that Rockefeller was dying. He had very serious heart problems. He knew he was dying. He had acknowledged as much to members of his family days before he died. It's entirely possible he would have died that night wherever he was.
So, where was he?
He worked all that day. He had been putting his house in order in any number of ways. He was working on a series of art books, one of which was about to be published. Late in the afternoon, he left room 5600, which is the Rockefeller office at the then RCA building, went to the Buckley School for a fundraiser to be addressed by Henry Kissinger. His sons both attended the Buckley School. I talked to people who were there who noticed how gray he seemed. And in fact, he only drank Dubonnet, and he asked for something stronger. he was clearly not well. Anyway, he went home, had dinner. I talked to Mrs. Rockefeller. Must have been difficult for her to relive that evening, but her view was he didn't want to die in front of his boys. He didn't want to drop dead at the apartment. Now, you have to remember, his mother had died of a massive heart attack following a perfect weekend with her family. And Nelson foresaw the same. Nelson, that's the death he wanted, when I say death on his own terms. She also told me she heard him pick up the phone and call Megan Marshak, who had joined his staff as vice president and who had been working as head of an editorial team on this series of books, and whom it was very clear to other people was part of a romantic relationship.
How old was Megan Marshak?
Megan Marshak was 25 at the time. And she lived in an apartment three doors down 54th Street from the Rockefeller townhouses. There were twin townhouses at 13 and 15, West 54th. And so anyway, that's where, according to the story, they met, were working on this book. He had a heart attack, died instantly. It was reported that the police found him on the floor, fully clothed, papers. I mean, all of a piece. That was the story that was given out to the press. Hugh Morrow, for reasons that we've discussed, said that he was
his press spokesman.
His press spokesman said that he was stricken, in fact, at room 5600. Claimed that he never had, for whatever reason, claimed that he had no history of heart disease, which is simply wrong. And of course, literally, there were press going to the RCA building, expecting a body to be brought down. And anyway, the whole thing unraveled over the weekend. The importance of that, 35 years later, is this. That night, in my opinion, marked a transformation. As great as the second night in the Cow Palace marked a transformation. Only this time, instead of a political party, it was the way journalists covered, quote, the private lives of politicians. You can draw a line from January 26, 1979, to Gary Hart and the monkey business, and on Jim McGreevy and Anthony Weiner, and you know, you name it. I believe that beginning with the New York Times, and it's important to know why the Times did what they did. I interviewed someone at the Times, who shall remain nameless, but someone, Al Marshall, who had been very close to Rockefeller, who told me he got a call from the Times, who said, look, you people have never lied to us before. You may have spun things, but you've never lied. We are sufficiently outraged that we have five reporters working the story, and we're subjecting the 911 call to electronic analysis. And armed with that information, and one other piece of information that I got from a confidential source, suggesting that you know, there was this missing hour between when the call was supposedly made and then when the story was put out.
This is in January of 1979.
January of 1979. And the whole story, in effect, sort of revolves around what happened during that hour. And it was strongly intimated to me that the call, the 911 call, it turned out was not made by Megan Marshak, but was made by a second woman who lived in Megan's building, a woman named Panchita Pierce, a very prominent journalist.
Did you talk to her?
I asked to talk to her, and she declined.
Hey, did you talk to Megan Marshak?
No, she also didn't respond. Those are really the only two people I did 150 interviews, and those are really the only two people who I asked to speak to who declined.
Did you say there were three people that actually saw the body?
The third person, by his own acknowledgement, was a man named Joe Canzeri. Joe Canzeri was the uber advanced man, the ultimate fixer. He ran Pocatico for Nelson. I mean, a very competent man. His code name was Little Caesar. And he could be trusted to take care of anything. He told me in an interview before his death that he was one of three people who knew what happened that night. He wouldn't go into detail, but he dropped clues. But I subsequently learned from friends of his that the story that he had told over the years was, in fact, not true. That, in fact, he told people, close friends, in later years, that he himself had actually gone to 54th Street as part of a kind of an emergency effort to clean up the scene and to redress the body.
Body, you say, was without clothes.
That's what I was told by the paramedic who was first on the scene. And here's a discrepancy.
And by the way, you name him, Jim Pateras. Jim Pateras is still alive today.
Yeah, absolutely. Had a very distinguished career in medicine and is associated with the Yale.
Was he there and one of the first, other than those three, to see the...
Yeah. And here's the remaining, if you will, mystery. Because there's a clear discrepancy between his account of what he found, which I find completely credible, and the original story put out by the police. And the missing link just may be one other source who indicated there was a man, unfortunately deceased, history professor, named Trumbull Higgins, lifelong New Yorker, who taught a class at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York. And one night, two members of his class, two cops, offered him a ride home. And as they approached West 54th Street, they began reminiscing about that night and suggesting that, in fact, they were called not to 13 West 54th Street, but to 25 West 54th Street. And that, in fact, the former vice president's remains were moved from 25 to 13. I don't know if that's true. I think it fits. But my approach to this is, as a cold case, I think the historical significance, as I say, lies in the fact that, based on what I've learned, that historical question that I mentioned earlier, I believe Nelson Rockefeller died instantly. I don't believe he could have been saved. I don't think anyone was responsible that evening willfully or by neglect for his death. And then the only other real historical significance, and it's lasting, is its impact upon journalism.
You quote Happy Rockefeller in the book, heading up one of the sections. Once a small creature came into my world. He took the largest fortune in the world and decided to enjoy it.
Yeah.
Did she say that to you?
Yeah, she did. She did. I understood, by the way, just in the course of the time I spent with her, much of what Nelson found irresistible in this woman, including a kind of wisdom. You know, I pointed out she didn't go to college, like lots of women of her class at that time. But she's a lifelong reader, voracious reader, especially of history and literature. But beyond that, there's the street smarts. There's an instinctive grasp of human motive, and you can understand why, among other things, Nelson relied on her judgment of people.
This book is 14 years in the making. It's on